Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
Hi, this is Pat Iyer and Kathleen Eisenhart talking with you from the perspective of a legal nurse consultant with extensive experience who is currently working as her primary role helping defense attorneys. Kathleen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Pat. It's an honor to be here.
When Kathleen and I were planning out this show, we were thinking about all the topics that we could cover, and we decided that we wanted to focus in this show on the critical question of working on the defense side, and specifically working with expert witnesses. Kathleen, what's been your experience in terms of when defense attorneys start thinking about hiring experts, or maybe I should take it a step back and say, when does the insurance carrier start thinking about hiring experts?
Good question, Pat. So I'm generally only familiar with the Florida process, and our primary clients tend to be large institutions, but it really would depend on the type of client that one has. And whether or not they have a risk management program, what type of risk management program that they have. So really at any time in the litigation process, even pre-litigation, a client can request a review of the records or of the incident, and you may require a expert review. I'm sorry, the sun is like all of a sudden really strong. So it would depend, and we've had experiences where there was a client that was had an event that was ongoing. The patient hadn't been even discharged from the facility, and they asked for an internal review and then a review by the attorney. And in that case, we found an expert even before there was any informal or formal litigation. So it really depends on the situation. If you are, let's say, a physician, and you may not find out about the case or any event until after, at least in Florida, informal discovery or the notice of intent has been served upon you. So it's very varied. And it would also depend on your risk management department too, how proactive they may be, if there is a risk management department, in looking at incidents that occur in their facility or with their insured. And then every insurance company, you know, we generally don't deal directly with them, at least in my experience. So when they get notice of a claim or an event, it would depend on what their process is. So it's very varied. Generally in Florida, we have a pre-suit process where the potential plaintiff, they're called a claimant, serves a notice of intent on the defendant or defendants. That would be generally the first time you would find out that there is some claim against your client, and you would start the review process. And during that process, which is about 90 days or so, then you would need to have an expert review during that time.
And in various parts of the country, there's a very similar process. Some places require the plaintiff attorney to serve a certificate of merit or an affidavit of merit indicating that an expert has reviewed the case and feels there's reason to proceed. It's not ironclad. The expert is not expected at that point to nail down all of the comments or criticisms or deviations. In some states, that process is not required. I think what you're describing for those people who are listening who are not in Florida and may not be familiar with how the American system works, there is a strong need in many states to try to establish that this case has some merit and is not frivolous, which is the terrible adjective assigned to cases that may have no merit at all and the attorney is fishing around looking for a recovery. So as we think about experts, you know, I'll also interject Kathleen at times to broaden our perspective if I can contribute something to this conversation. One of the big things related to experts that has changed a lot in the 30 years or so I've been doing legal nurse consulting is who's qualified to be an expert. In the past, a physician could testify about nursing care. Nurses, of course, could never testify about physician care. It never seemed to work the other way around. Mm-hmm. How is that issue now being handled in your experience?
Well, excellent question. In Florida, there is actually a statute that speaks to who can opine as an expert. And it's a statute, let me scroll down, Florida 766-102. And it guides attorneys in the state of Florida on how to choose the appropriate expert for the situation. It primarily speaks to physicians, and it depends on whether the physician's a specialist or a generalist or neither. And there's certain guidelines on what type of past experience they have to have. Generally, if you're a specialist, it's 3 years in that same specialty. If you're a generalist, 5 years. And if you're other, it's 3 years. And then you can be an instructor or a researcher. Our Florida statute also speaks to a physician who can opine on other professional care. And according to 766-1026, a physician can opine on nursing standards of care, written right in the statute. Now, I can say generally in my experience, we tend to seek nurses to speak to nurses' standard of care. But there are situations where we would have a physician speak to it, particularly, let's say, in a pre-suit process, where pre-suit's an informal process, which, speaking to what you said, Pat, is an attempt to weed out the frivolous lawsuit. So when a claimant brings a claim, they generally have to have a corroborating physician expert or provider expert affidavit to show good faith that it is a meritorious claim. There are exceptions to that rule. One of the exceptions is if the requested records of the facility or provider weren't provided to the claimant in 10 days, then that potential defendant waives the right to an affidavit. So there are some exceptions, but generally, yes. So in Florida, physicians can speak to nursing standard of care. Nurses cannot speak to physician standard of care, and nurses do not speak to causation.
All the little nuances. You know, in some states, a person who's teaching in an accredited facility is a faculty member, for example, is considered to be qualified. What I have seen is what you have identified is that attorneys are much more aware, particularly when it comes to nursing cases, to have a nurse testifying about another nurse and a nurse with the same background, not a nurse is a nurse is a nurse. We can't generalize that to that extent in the United States, although it used to be that way. It is no longer that way.
I agree.
I also remember a conversation I had with an attorney who was defending a emergency department nurse practitioner, and he supplied an emergency department physician. Now, this was in a New Jersey case. And the plaintiff attorney said, you need to have a emergency department nurse practitioner as your expert. And he had to come back to me, even though I had tried to warn him, I don't think that's going to fly. He had to come back and say, okay, Pat, you know, now I need an emergency department nurse practitioner. Can you help me? And I was able to assist him with a well-qualified expert. Mm-hmm. So there can be judges who can decide this particular expert is not qualified to speak about the standards of care in the question.
Agreed. And there's actually case law in Florida that tries to narrow down and speak to who can be the expert speaking about the defendant. And it is almost specialty for specialty at a physician level and even a nursing level. And there have been cases that I've seen where we have excluded various experts because they are not in that same specialty to opine on the defendant in question. And that included a nurse practitioner. So while the statute does say physicians can opine on nursing, it has been changed through case law to some degree, and it's case specific for each situation.
Mm-hmm. You're working on a case. The attorney who is working with you says, "All right, Kathleen, I think it's time for us to find an expert on this case." What kind of sources can you recommend that legal nurse consultants check in order to identify people who would be appropriate experts?
Well, that's very attorney specific in my experience. Generally, attorneys will have a database of their own, experts they've used before or referrals they've gotten through somewhere else. There are some attorneys that use expert witness services, the online services. Some will and some won't. There is some question as to those expert services that you're hiring the professional to, you're hiring their opinion. I'm not saying that does occur, but there's a perception perhaps with some attorneys. And so some will not use that. There's also, you go and you slog through the research. You have a very specific expert that you're looking for relative to a claim or allegation in the matter, and you need an expert to opine on let's say transfusion related acute lung injury. And so that's someone you would have to go and look through the literature and decide and find a potential expert in that field and contact them to see if they're interested in speaking. So it can be a broad search, or it can be a very specific. Generally, in my experience, we don't use expert witness services, but I do know that experts on the other side have come from those services, and they're neither good nor bad. And there's quite a few out there for nurses and for physicians. So,
and most of the time when I was talking to plaintiff attorneys about locating experts, they had a perception that it was extremely easy for defense attorneys and defense legal nurse consultants to find expert witnesses to review cases, that people were lining up, raising their hand and saying, I'll help. And for those of you who are listening to this podcast on audio format, Kathleen just shook her head. Tell me why you shook your head. No.
Well, you could have an expert database of 1,000 experts, but every case is so unique, and there's nuances to the allegations and the events at hand. And so you need the expert to be expert in those nuances and to be able to speak to it. You can't, let's just say there's an interventional radiology case, but it's relative to a neurosurgical issue, and you have interventional radiologists that aren't neurosurgical interventional radiologists. And so now you have to have that expert specific to that nuanced part of your case. So it is not easy, and you don't want to use the same expert over and over again, because it can look somewhat poor in the sense that, you know, they've opined positively for you in the past, you're hiring them again, perhaps, you know, they're just going to continue to tell you what you want. A good expert will never do that. I'm not saying they do, but a good expert will never. It's the perception of that. But it is challenging to find, because every case is so unique and every case requires maybe more than one expert, and you'll have experts that disagree when you find them. So you may find an expert, but it may not be one that provides you the opinion that is most helpful to your story that you create out of the events, and you may just need to seek another one. Or a couple more.
When I recall what I went through trying to find experts when I was running my business full time, I do a little bit of work now again as a legal nurse consultant, but I sold my company in 2015. I remember the impossible request to find me a female gynecologist in the county of Westchester, New York, who's willing to review this case in the next 2 weeks. And it was those kinds of requests that made me think we sometimes have to filter through dozens of people to find that particular person. You know, I remember wanting to say, "Oh, would you like somebody only with blonde hair and blue eyes, or only brunette?" And just in my frustration of, I don't know if we can do that. that type of narrow type of search is for a business owner who's not being paid by the hour. That kind of narrow search is very challenging.
And I agree with that. And I find, you know, physicians generally are easier to locate because they advertise not their services, but if you're looking, you know, we look oftentimes at your level one trauma centers, your tertiary centers, you know, the websites have their names. Generally, you can find their contact information, but nurses are harder to locate. They're not publicly advertised in places. And so, and especially if you need, let's say you need a patient care technician, we had a matter where the patient care tech was actually named. We luckily didn't have to find an expert for her, but we've had another case where a radiology tech was specifically named in a matter. And so those types of specific specialties are much more challenging to locate.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes quite a bit of time and searching. That's when you look at your contacts, you know, your other defense attorneys or even plaintiff attorneys, because everybody has a database, and you try to seek that. But each case is unique. It's rare to have a case where you can just go back to your database and say, oh, that'll work perfectly. That's more rare.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a bit of online searching and using your coworkers.
Well, now you have a name. Now you have a person who says, yes, I'll send my resume and my fee schedule. What do you look at when you are evaluating or vetting that expert?
So some of that vetting is upfront. So you contact the expert when you look at, if you can, sometimes there's CVs online, sometimes there isn't, but you're going to look at what that expert is specializing in. If I want a pulmonologist, but they specialize in pediatrics, then I'm going to vet that first. Once I get the CV, I get the fee schedule. We look at what their expertise is, and we look at their fee schedule, and each client decides how much they might want to spend on an expert. That's, you know, insurance companies tend to be a little more limiting on what you can spend. There are some experts we've had, you know, pediatric neurosurgeons who charge, you know, $1,000 an hour. That's a hard sell for some clients. And so when you see that fee schedule, you might say, well, I might need to go somewhere else. But you will look at that, and then you can set up a conference. And generally we do a vetting conference with the attorney. If it's a nurse, I do the vetting first. And then if I'm comfortable with that nurse, then I will set up a conference with the attorney.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you look for? You look for how well-spoken they are when you talk to them on the phone. You look for, do they listen? Do you, when I vet a nurse, it's more how much experience do they have, or even the physicians, how much experience do you have? Have you testified before? Being a testifying expert is not an easy place to be. It's an adversarial environment. And there's a way to speak in the legal world that's different than speaking to your co-physician. You know, the verbiage is different, and the standard of care is a legal construct. It's not a medical construct. And so there's some understanding that needs to be had by the expert to speak in that realm. And when you have somebody who's not ever spoken in that realm before or tried to opine in a legal realm, they can flounder, or they can say things perhaps unintentionally that aren't the best. So
I remember talking to a woman who was a paralegal who worked in a law firm in Louisville, and she told me about a physician expert who got off the plane to go directly to the courthouse, and he had blonde hair, which was in a ponytail. He was wearing shorts and a flip-flop. And she said, my mouth fell open. You know, they had nothing that would have warned them that this guy was going to show up to testify wearing those clothes. And he looked at the paralegal and he said, now, don't worry, I know what I'm doing. And she thought, this is not going to end well. And he got on the stand and he was phenomenal as a testifier.
Interesting.
But you had to look past that appearance. Have you ever had a situation where an expert's appearance in court gave you concern?
Well, I haven't actually been to court. We've done quite a few depositions. And with the advent of Zoom, all of our depositions now have been by Zoom. It's rare to actually be in the presence unless mm-hmm. it's our nurse client, it's a fact witness. But Zoom has really taken away the professional dress that's required. Even the attorneys, they don't dress in the full three suits. Now at trial, it is probably very, very different, you know, but in Zoom, it's much more casual. Mm. And our experts are being Zoom, you know, on the Zoom call in their office, they're at home, you know, the dogs bark in the background. So there's been a lot of leeway and allowance for that. And so I think the best part about Zoom is we've learned to look past the appearances much more than before. And we really look at the substance of what they're saying and how they're saying it. How professional do they come across? How confident in themselves and their opinions are they? Do they understand how to speak in that realm? And we've had some very, very wonderful experts testify, and we've had some very poor ones. The setting is not really, at least deposition-wise.
Mm-hmm. What makes a poor expert in your experience?
Before we continue with the show, I'd like to share this special announcement with you.
Have you considered exploring other avenues in nursing? Would you like to become a legal nurse consultant or expand your legal nurse practice? I have the perfect virtual program for you, the LNC Success Virtual Conference. I'm Barbara Levin, past president of the American Association of Legal Nurse Consultants. My friend and colleague, Patricia Iyer, and I are hosting our fifth virtual Legal Nurse Consulting Success Conference, March 3 and 4, 2022. We invite you to be the detective with our program Crash, which is a case study about a motor vehicle accident, and there is a little twist that ends up with medical malpractice. You will learn about analyzing medical records for a motor vehicle accident and how to find the pearls in the case. Arlene Klopatsky is our nurse attorney, and she is very knowledgeable about biomechanical engineering. She will discuss the mechanisms of injury, such as, do the injuries sustained by the individuals actually match up to the accident? How do you determine who the driver is when people were ejected from the vehicle? Kenyetta Christmas is our advanced practice ICU nurse, and she will present topics about the complications that have occurred and care required of those individuals while in the ICU. Joe Flores is our litigation nurse attorney, and he will present liability issues. Our respiratory therapist, who joins me today, is Joe Cura. He is faculty at Northeastern University, the past director of pulmonary services at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. He and I will explain the pearls of respiratory care, the oxyhemoglobin curve, and the importance of maintaining oxygen therapy. Learn which documents you need to review when analyzing respiratory care cases, as well as the standard of care. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you, Barbara. It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Can you share with our audience a few items that you'll be discussing in your presentation?
Sure. In addition to what you've already mentioned, the oxyhemoglobin curve, this is a very interesting case. We have a gentleman, and I don't want to give away too much, who MVA, as you mentioned, a motor vehicle accident, and ended up needing to get trached, and there were some challenges and some things that occurred, especially at the end, and what were some of the things that they needed to look at, and what were some of the things that weren't reviewed, weren't considered. And I think one of the things that I hope that the audience and the participants will get out of this is things don't always appear as they seem, and you have to sometimes dig deep and go back to the basics and think about the basics, and we get so caught up in a lot of different things. So that's where I'm really going, and it's really to just help people have more tools in their toolbox to understand different things.
That is so important, especially for our audience. Some are beginners and some are very advanced legal nurses, and they need those tools in their toolbox to dig deep into those medical records.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah. So I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it. It's a great opportunity. I've done a number of cases. I've been reading cases since 2006, focusing on mechanical ventilation, critical care, trach care, oxygenation, transport, all these things. So this kind of ties into a lot of those areas for me. And it's something that I hope I'll be able to share some information that others will find very helpful.
Well, we're excited to have you. Please join our LNC Success Conference, March 3 and 4, 2022. Please see the link below, lnc.tips/March2022 virtual. We look forward to seeing you.
Thank you.
Now let's return to the show.
Wow. A couple things. Lack of confidence. We've had a nurse expert on the plaintiff side who was absolutely confident in her opinions. As wrong as they were absolutely confident. She was absolutely confident. And that sells. That sells. But when you, we had a, it's not an expert, but she was a defendant and she was deposed. She was a physician and you would expect physicians to be very well spoken. She crumbled in her deposition and they ended up pre-suiting her and now she's an actual defendant. You're under pressure. You're speaking in a situation that is not normal. If you're a clinician, you're used to speaking professionally to people, but this is a different situation. So being confident in yourself in that situation, being able to articulate at a very, I shouldn't say low level, because when these attorneys are speaking and asking questions, it's high level. So being able to articulate clearly your opinions and maintain those opinions consistently through the deposition. You don't have to be right or wrong, but you have to be confident. And that comes across looking at it's Zoom now. So looking at the camera, mm-hmm. Being able to speak to the research, the evidence-based medicine, that tends to come up quite a bit. And being able to articulate what is or isn't valuable or appropriate in that particular evidence-based article that one side is trying to present as, you know, the standard of care. So, and then for nursing to understand what the standard of care is, I found very few nurses that we've deposed on the plaintiff side that seem to understand what standard of care means in a nursing realm for a nurse. And it's been very, very interesting. And these are either new experts or very experienced testifying experts, but do not understand the legally what they're saying, what they're speaking to.
Mm-hmm.
I find it very interesting.
And then how much involvement do you have as working in-house as an LNC in working with the experts throughout the case?
In my role as in-house legal nurse consultant, I locate the experts, I vet them, I'm involved in all of the meetings, all the prep. I write their summaries when we have our meetings, and I attend the deposition, oftentimes providing information or documents, references, and that kind of thing as needed for the deposition. So I'm very involved with them in all aspects of the case.
Questions have come up for me on several occasions from people who say, and this goes back in a way to qualifications, I might have this particular skeleton in my closet. For those listening who are not Americans and may not be familiar with that, that's something really bad that could impact your credibility. And these individuals have asked me, do you think I could be qualified as an expert? Do you think anybody would find out about this negative thing in my background? What would you say to a person who's considering being an expert, but perhaps got fired from a job or a nursing license was suspended or maybe a DUI, driving under the influence? What do you say about those types of things? And are they automatic disqualifiers?
I wouldn't say they're automatic disqualifiers. Every attorney manages the impeachment of the other expert, the plaintiff expert or the defense expert, in a different way. At the deposition level, I have not seen an active attempt to bring out the skeletons in the closet. At, in a trial situation, I can't speak to that. As far as excluding the expert for their opinions through motions in limine or even a Daubert challenge, I haven't yet seen the attempt to bring out those skeletons. I would say to the potential expert that if you have a very valid and reasonable explanation for the events that occurred, and it's a past event and you've overcome it, being upfront and honest with the potential attorney that you want to work for is the best thing to do. And the attorney will decide whether it's something he wants or she wants to work with and manage. I would not say it's an absolute no that you can't be an expert testifier. I don't.
Mm-hmm. I got involved in a case as a plaintiff expert where the defense nursing expert had multiple sclerosis, and the attorney inquired from the Board of Nursing whether her license was active at the time this incident took place. She was an expert witness for the defense. And the Board of Nursing came back and said, yes, her license was active, but would you like to know about when we suspended her license? And the plaintiff attorney said, oh, do tell. And it turned out she had taken her husband's prescription pad and was writing Xanax prescriptions for herself 24 times that she gave herself Xanax. The judge allowed the jury to hear about this. There was a lot of attempts to keep it out, but it did come out. And the attorney who hired me was able to ask me questions like, have you ever written prescriptions for yourself on your husband's pad? A variety of questions that showed the sharp contrast, and our side won on that case.
Interesting.
Yet her client didn't know that she had done this. That's one of the incidents of things that I can think of that have come out that have been really devastating for an expert witness. So certainly the circumstances change, but forging prescriptions for yourself and having your license suspended is not a great background for the inevitable poking around. Oh, is your license active?
Well, that was an astute plaintiff attorney, and I'm sure that does go on. It was unfortunate she wasn't upfront and honest about that. It would have made the disclosure of that ahead of the disclosure in trial less impactful.
Yes.
Or they would have chosen a different expert.
And, part of the strategy is when my client found out about this, he didn't necessarily broadcast it to his adversary to say, hey, I got a surprise for you when you walk into courtroom, because you're going to be really sorry that you got this woman. There is a certain amount of strategy and jockeying and holding back and not showing all the cards to the adversary that goes on that sometimes can result in some quite unpleasant surprises. And nobody likes surprises in the courtroom, in my experience.
Agreed. Yes, there is quite a bit of jockeying and positioning.
Yeah. Well, and now you're working on the case and you find that you need additional experts. Tell our listener, in your experience, can they be produced at any time? Can they, be called into the courtroom the day before the trial begins, or are there discovery regulations that govern the last time when an attorney can produce a new expert?
I would say generally, not absolutely, generally in Florida, there are discovery cutoffs. And one of those is disclosing your expert testifying witnesses, disclosing your fact witnesses. There's a discovery cutoff as far as, the non-party discovery and whatnot. Could there be a situation where an expert is brought in at the last minute? I could see that. I haven't personally witnessed that. But generally, no, we disclose our experts and the other side deposes them to get their opinions on record through a deposition. And that needs to be done up front and before trial. So it would be unlikely to have an expert. We have up until a certain time before trial, it's called a case management order, and they provide all of the discovery cutoffs. Now that's negotiable with all parties, and you can go right up until before trial if all parties agree for disclosures of discovery or experts. Mm-hmm. But generally, I would say no, you don't want to bring somebody, partly because you don't want to bring an expert in. You just don't know what the expert's going to say under pressure. And even as you know, you've spoken with them and you've prepped them for deposition, they go to deposition and they may say some things that you're like, well, that's not something we discussed in our prep meeting. And so they can surprise even the side that is trying to disclose them or bring them out to deposition or trial. So not the best idea, but I'm sure it can occur.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have been deposed hundreds of times. And I have to say that it is one of the hottest seats that you can sit in, other than trial, which is in some ways a little bit easier because the attorneys who are taking an expert's deposition, in my experience, can behave more badly in a deposition room than they typically do in the courtroom where there's more witnesses, judges, and jury watching mm-hmm. them having their temper tantrums or yelling or trying to intimidate or talking over or interrupting, which they can do a little bit more easily in a deposition room than in a courtroom. Although I don't know if that's happening quite as much on Zoom, where, you know, there is a video record of this as compared to doing a deposition in a conference room where there's no video recording of what went on.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, interesting, you mentioned video. Quite a few of our expert depositions are not videoed. So there's only the written transcript.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up to whoever is requesting the deposition of that expert to determine whether they want it videoed. Well, that's not true. I'm sure both sides could decide, oh, I want it, you know, videoed in the event that this expert can't be at trial for some mm-hmm. reason. There's a conflict. But generally, I have not seen the experts Zoom. Generally, we use Zoom. That's just a Kleenex, just a term being videoed.
But the Zoom recording itself creates a video recording.
If it's recorded, it's not being recorded necessarily.
Oh,
you have to actually hit record.
Right.
And I don't see that because I attend often. I attend them. Mm. You know, to listen in, and they're not being recorded that I see anyway.
So then there's a request court, that there would be a court reporter then who is occupying another Zoom window who is taking yes. down the testimony,
correct,
just as would occur in a room,
right? And they're just not physically present with the witness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting,
yeah. Oftentimes, the attorney for that expert isn't necessarily present with the witness either.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's, you know, virtual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
I vividly remember going to Princeton, New Jersey for a deposition with some attorneys who were in Alaska mm-hmm. well before Zoom. And it was done through a video link that was unstable at best. And they would be in the middle of a point. And then everybody would be staring at them going, hello.
Yeah.
The technology has come a long way from those days, but it was a very, in some ways, much less intimidating way of being deposed when they're on a screen on the wall, periodically caught in unflattering positions with their mouths open while we're sitting there in Princeton watching them get frozen. And then having to make the call, hello, we can't hear you, we can't see you. I preferred that, but it only happened a few times that way.
I would agree with you. I think the whole Zoom deposition process has, it's not informalized it because it's still, you know, testimony under oath, but it's much more relaxed in that sense, you know, mm-hmm. because the the, you know, the expert may not be able to get on, or some of the parties may not be able to get on. So you're not starting right at the right exact time, you know, the technical issues going on. And you're right, not having the attorney right there present does change the attorney that requested the deposition and asking the questions primarily. It changes the tone because you don't have that physical presence. So yes. I would agree with you. It is different, better in some fashion.
I had a telephone deposition early in my career, and that was even less intimidating because there was a telephone on the table with a voice coming out of it. Mm-hmm. When you are sitting across the table from an attorney, the attorney can use body language to attempt to intimidate you. A raised voice doesn't show up on a transcript, or a long pause does not show up, or a threatening finger in the air doesn't show up. And of course, always shows up on a recorded Zoom or another type of a recorded version. But it is in many ways much more pleasant to not have that person breathing across the table, not speaking germs, viruses in the context, but kind of blowing smoke out of the nostrils, trying to make the witness feel uncomfortable, intimidated to mess up, to say the wrong thing, to say something without thinking through the implications, make a quick retort, get into an argument. It's incredibly easy to do that when you're in the same room with the witness.
Agreed. In fact, speaking to your point about it's just a transcript and you don't get the nuances of the person either asking the questions or the witness, we had our own nurse expert being deposed and it was videoed. And I read the transcript and thought, wow, she did a phenomenal job. I watched the video and her body language was completely opposite to what her testimony was. And I was quite concerned and informed the attorney. I said, you know, she comes across as very unsure of herself, as very meek, stuttered. That doesn't come across in the transcript, but her appearance on the video was, I thought, detrimental. Despite what she said.
Mm-hmm. Well, are there any parting pieces of advice you would give somebody who's perhaps in the position of needing to locate experts?
Well, determine with the attorney what type of expert you're looking for first and get a good feel for what they prefer before you go out and just choose an expert. They may want somebody with a lot of experience. They may want somebody who has no experience and be able to train them. So that's very specific. The type of specialty and any other specific factors that the attorney would prefer. And then when you're vetting them, as Pat brought up, you know, they have a license that's active in the United States. They've practiced in the area that you need them to be practicing in for the past couple of years. And that they're willing to be a testifying expert. I've contacted individuals and who have done it and said, I will never do it again, even though they advertised it prior. Mm-hmm. So one, they have to be willing. The other thing is the venue that you're looking for. You know, if you're in accents can be difficult to overcome. And so you could find the expert. And then when you talk with them, their accent is so strong, it's hard to understand them. That may be difficult for the venue where the trial might be held. Mm-hmm. So,
those are all great points, Kathleen. I think about a woman who had a deposition in Washington, D.C., who was one of our experts, and she had never been deposed before. And the attorney was brutal. And she was driving through rush hour traffic in Washington, D.C., like 5 o'clock, which is always impressive if you've ever done that in your life. And she's sobbing to me about how she felt so demeaned and he was so nasty and she hated it and she would never do it again and she wouldn't go any further with this case. And please, 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 Pat, don't make me ever do this again. And the attorney who hired her is on my other line calling me to say she was awful. She was just awful. So I had to put him on hold and say to her, let's get you to the side of the road. let's calm down. Let me talk to the attorney. It's don't take it personally, which is a very easy thing to say, but very hard to listen to. So I got her safely on the side of the road. I got the attorney back and he said, I can't use her. She was just so terrible. And it made me realize, you know, she was literally risking her life driving in that traffic, crying so hard she couldn't see. And I thought, no lawsuit is worth losing your life over this type of experience. She was not ready. She was well prepared, but she was not of the temperament that she could manage this. And she discovered it with one case, and he understood, and we gave him a different expert, and she was grateful to be taken off the hook. It made such an impression on me to think about her driving at night, sobbing because she had been ripped apart in a deposition.
Yeah, it is very adversarial. There are some, you know, I'm sure, you know, you've been opposed hundreds of times, so many different styles of attorneys that attack or try to become your friend and make a conversation. And you have to have a certain mettle to do it. It is a difficult place to be. And I, for those that choose to be testifying experts, give them a lot of credit to be in that position and advocating for whichever side they choose. It is very difficult.
And rather than end on a real negative note, I do also want to emphasize that so many of the experts who I trained loved the detail-oriented aspect, the analytical challenges, the fact that when they took care of patients after reviewing a particular type of case, they would go, aha, now I know what happened, and would provide education, as I did, to people around them to say, no, I don't think we should check the blood transfusion at the nurse's station. I think we need to go to the bedside and do it with the patient's ID band. And here's why. I worked on a case in which, and then would give them the framework so they would understand. So many experts have told me how much they enjoy that intellectual challenge and the way that it impacts their own care of patients, as well as the care of patients around them, to help avoid what I think we all want is to reduce the number of injuries that patients experience in the healthcare system. And of course, to defend the people who are wrongly accused, as is the job of the defense. But to say, wouldn't it be nice if we could get rid of medical malpractice altogether and just everybody get quality care?
Agreed.
How can our listener connect with you after this podcast is over, Kathleen?
So you can email me directly. For my work email, it's k.eisenhart@eisenhartlnc.com.
Okay, and let's spell Eisenhart.
Sure, it's I as in igloo, S as in Sam, E as in elephant, N as in Nancy, H as in Harry, A as in apple, R as in red, and T as in toy. So k.eisenhart@eisenhartlnc.com.
Perfect. Thank you, Kathleen. I so appreciate being able to share stories and to talk about this challenging aspect of legal nurse consulting, a service that many attorneys highly value. They know how time-consuming and difficult it is to find experts, and they turn to legal nurse consultants for assistance in these kinds of cases.
Agreed. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
You are welcome. And thank you to you who's been watching this on our YouTube channel or listening to it on the audio channels for Legal Nurse Podcast. Come back next week or click on down for the next episode of our show. We are now in our sixth year of production, and so much appreciate you who contact me by email or by phone and say, I love your show and I listen to it as I'm driving to work or taking a walk or cleaning the house. That makes a lot of difference for me and keeps me enthusiastic about the show and what it brings to you. Thank you. My name is Pat Iyer, and I have with me Ethel Wills, who is a legal nurse consultant and a nursing home expert. And we've been chatting about a serious issue in nursing homes that can lead to residents dying, and that is dehydration and malnutrition. Ethel is a person who reviews cases and testifies about a variety of long-term care issues. And this is one that comes into her office on a fairly common basis. Ethel, could you give our watcher who's watching this on our YouTube channel or listening to it on the audio channels a little bit of a sense of what we covered in your podcast?
Pat, there's some of the things that we covered was the vulnerability of the elderly to both dehydration and malnutrition because of their weakened state, their frailty, and also possibility because of their other health issues that may be plagued by, such as dementia, Parkinson's, those types of things. And also there's this assessment of the person, the elderly, for risk factors of for dehydration and malnutrition was another thing we covered, such as having poor oral health, broken teeth, poor fitting dentures, and then the importance of having those things assessed. Swallowing issues was another thing that possibly could lead to both those factors. And then there's need for an assessment of those. The lab work, if there's a concern for malnutrition, dehydration, we also discuss what labs to look for. Look at the protein levels, such as prealbumin, albumin level, the sodium level in the blood, the potassium level, and also look at the urinalysis, such as the urine color. And then feeding environment was also another thing we covered. It's much different in the nursing home than in the hospital. There's not a community where you have a person walking down the hall passing trays. The residents are all taken to a dining room, such a community dining room. And there's assistance being offered if needed for someone to be fed, and also persons to engage with at the next table. There's a need to encourage eating, and a lot of times that's done by putting in an environment where others are eating. And another thing with coverage was the need for a nutrition assessment, looking at nutrition assessment, whether or not that person was assessed when they came in for the basic needs, caloric needs, fluid needs, and the weight, and whether or not there was what adequate intake is considered sufficient to be maintained, to maintain that weight level. And the role of the CNA was also discussed. This CNA assists with feeding. Also, the CNA also records all this, the weights and the intakes, and whether or not that person was incontinent. Those are factors. Incontinence is a factor that can cause, if there's a lot of a diarrhea, that type of thing, it can cause dehydration. And those are things that they should be looking for. And those are some of the things we also discuss. In a nutshell, there's a lot of different factors that can cause dehydration that should be assessed. A lot of issues that can cause malnutrition. And then legal nurse consultant evaluating that record should look for several different factors. Look at the medical records to see what baseline care plan was done, what's on the care plan, and whether or not the care plan was being followed.
There are so many things that we covered. Now, Ethel, as you do that summary, it reminds me of the many topics that we addressed in talking about the LNC's analysis of dehydration and malnutrition. This is an area that requires an analytical thinking and sometimes a bit of skepticism. Ethel brought out in her podcast that if you're looking at a food intake sheet that shows 100% of the meal was consumed by the resident, and yet the resident is losing weight, you need, as the legal nurse consultant, to put that through your filter and think about, is that indeed accurate documentation? Or was somebody just going through the forms, checking the charts, writing things by rote without that information being accurate? You'll learn more about that, as well as all the factors that Ethel described in her podcast, by catching Ethel Will's podcast, as we talk about dehydration and malnutrition in the nursing home environment on Legal Nurse Podcast. Be sure to get her show and take notes. You're going to find a lot of nuggets in what she shares.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.